Welcome to another episode of the Sanskrit Studies podcast. My name is Antonia Ruppel and my guest today is Professor Robert Zaidenbos. Robert, if you and I were to meet on a plane or on a train and I asked you, so what do you do? What would your answer be?
Well, actually, this situation has arisen many times in my life. And what I usually do is plainly say that I am an Indologist. And then I wait, and I give my partner in conversation a chance to understand what I'm saying. And sometimes people actually know the word, especially here in Germany. Less so in other countries. And if not, then I can tell by the look on their face that they don't know what I'm talking about. And then I will explain what I do. Indology is, of course, a very broad field. It's the basically it's the academic study of Indian culture, primarily through Indian languages and writings in those languages. And in my personal case, my speciality within the field of Sanskrit studies is philosophy and religion. And when I reduce my explanation of what I do to this, that I am a scholar of Indian philosophy and religion, most people understand that.
And how do they react to it? With interest? With incredulity? Why on earth would one? Or what's your experience been?
Oh, there's quite a variety of possible reactions to that. There are some people who themselves are not at all interested in this, and then there's a quick change of topic. But there are others who are fascinated, and they say, oh, isn't that interesting? I've never met anyone like this before. Can you tell me more about it? And that can be the start of a rather long and lively and often interesting conversation.
And how did you first become interested in things to do with India?
Oh, I know that rather precisely it began when I was a child. Our family was still living in Canada, and we had an American encyclopedia at home, Collier's Encyclopedia. My father always said he had bought this encyclopedia for his child. I was born 2 months after that, so that was my encyclopedia. And as a child, I think I was 7 or 8 years old, I became interested in languages. So I went to the encyclopedia and I just leafed through the encyclopedia. And you know what encyclopedias are like. They are full of articles that are linked to each other. One article refers to the next. So I read about Dutch, that we spoke at home, English, of course, but everybody outside the home was speaking, French, the other language in Canada, and from there to other related languages. And finally, I ended up reading about the languages of India. And of course, Sanskrit is historically the most prominent, important language of all in India. So I guess I was about 8 years old when I learned what Sanskrit is. And then this process repeated itself a few years later. I think I was 12 or 13 years old. I became interested in philosophy and religion. And the same thing happened. I went to the encyclopedia. I started reading about philosophy, first of all, Western philosophy in its many forms. And then some articles referred to articles concerning Indian philosophy. And then I started reading about Indian philosophy. And the authors of those articles, of course, referred to sources of information, and those were texts in Sanskrit. I already knew what Sanskrit is, and in this way, I learned that there are many highly interesting things in Sanskrit. So I must have been 12 or 13 years old at the time.
And you mentioned that you read about Indian philosophy. What concepts or what ideas did you find particularly striking?
A number of concepts. And first of all, something that fascinates many people outside India, the idea of metempsychosis. Punarjanma, rebirth, and the idea that in every person, or in every living being for that matter, there is a core that does not die when the body dies, but is born again, and it can be born over and over and over, innumerable times. And I thought, yes, why not? If this really is so, and that was an intuitive feeling I had, call it a religious feeling. If it is so, that there is something in me that is essentially different from the wrappings, from the body. And that for some reason, this core of my being became embodied. Why should it happen only once? It is so miraculous that it happens once. Why can this miracle not be repeated over and over again? So this idea appealed to me immediately. And I continued reading about this idea and connected ideas, such as the karma doctrine. And that made immense sense to me. And another thing that I found immediately striking, already from these encyclopedia articles that I read when I was 12 or 13 years old, and this was confirmed by my later studies and my reading of Sanskrit texts, is the character of religious thought in India, or call it philosophical thought. In any case, religious thinking, philosophical thinking, they are closely related, they overlap largely, and in India, more than in the Western world, there's a huge overlap. Very often, we read an author, and it's very hard for us to say, is this person a theologian or is he a philosopher? It doesn't matter. I like this German word, Weltanschauung, often translated as worldview, something that can be used as an umbrella term to subsume under it religion and philosophy. I found that in Indian thought, there was a very strong analytical and rational tendency, something that I missed in the religions that are historically the dominant religions in the Western world where I grew up. I found this very fascinating, and I found that this approach to existential questions, questions like, who am I? Where am I from? What is the meaning of life? What happens to me after this life? I found that this Indian approach was much more satisfying to what I knew from the predominant Western religions. And this is what ultimately led me to become a student of Sanskrit and Indology.
So how did your personal path go from there, from your interests kindled by this encyclopedia, going through various articles, getting to know all sorts of concepts and ideas? What did you do with that? What did you do with that while you were still in school? And what did you do with it at college or university?
It was not a straight path. In school, I did not read any Indian languages yet. I had to read things in translation. I had to read secondary literature, what scholars had written about Indian philosophy, about Indian religions. So I read quite a lot of secondary literature and things in translations. I read translations of the Upanishads. I found that very interesting. And then in the final year of high school, I was in the middle of preparing exams, but also thinking of what next? What will I do when I finish high school? I have to do something else. What will it be? And I was very hesitant. I, I had a number of interests which I could pursue professionally, but I didn't really know what. And I finished my high school in the Netherlands, where my father was from. And the universities in the Netherlands, also in other countries, they have information days where offene Tage, they call them in Germany, where high school pupils can go to the university and talk with people about the various courses and curricula that are offered there. And this will help high school pupils decide what to do after they leave school. I had written to a few universities in the Netherlands for information, and they sent me booklets, sort of catalogs of everything they have to offer. Mind you, this was long ago, in the pre-internet period. So they sent you booklets printed on paper.
How quaint.
Yes, nowadays it is very odd and old-fashioned. But I had these booklets from Leiden, from Amsterdam, from Utrecht. And one day I was in the middle of preparing for some high school exam, I forgot which one. And I was getting tired and I wanted to do something else, some diversion. And the booklet from Utrecht was lying on my desk. And lazily, I opened that booklet. And I lifted the back cover up and I saw the last page of the index. And in the upper left-hand corner of the index, I saw the word Sanskrit. I saw that and I thought, whoa, you can actually study that here in Europe. How fascinating. So I went to the corresponding page number. I read the article about Indian studies at the University of Utrecht. I became increasingly enthusiastic. I thought, this is wonderful. Maybe this is what I want. And there was a telephone number. Call this number for further information. A few minutes later, I was downstairs at the telephone. I dialed this number. I spoke with the secretary of the Institute for Oost-Tsjetaan, the Institute for Oriental Languages. Later, I learned that this lady was Mrs. Honda, the wife of the great Sanskritist, Jan Honda. We spoke a bit on the telephone, and Mrs. Honda said, well, I think it's best that you come to Utrecht, and we'll have a personal conversation about this, and you can ask me anything you want, and we'll go into this in full detail. And I said, yes, I want to come. We made an appointment. I went to Utrecht. I spoke with Mrs. Honda for an hour, I think, and returned to Eindhoven, where our family was living. And I told my parents, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to study Sanskrit. And that's what I did.
What was their reaction to that?
The reaction was positive. I was blessed with parents who gave us children great liberty in deciding how to shape our lives. My father had only one condition. He hated his own profession. And he told me, if you see how much I suffer under my job, and you, my own son, decide to do that, it means there's something wrong with your character. I will throw you out of the house. I will disown you as a son, and I never want to see you again. Is that clear? and I said, yes, Father, that's clear. So when I returned from Utrecht, and I said, I know what to do. I'm going to study Sanskrit and Indology. My father said, okay, son, you know what I said. There's one thing you're not allowed to do. You can do anything else. I told you, you can study anything you want. That's fine. You don't have to study. If you want to become a taxi driver, I'll help you buy a taxi. Your choice. if you want to do Sanskrit, you have my blessing. But tell me one thing, what is Sanskrit? And then I told him, well, it's a classical language of India. Oh, yeah, yeah, he said, yeah, yeah, you remember that. And he was not at all convinced that this would be a wise choice for a professional future, because he was rather skeptical about studies in the humanities in the first place. And, yeah, and then if you study something rather eccentric, like Indian languages, and not just that, but an ancient classical Indian language, well, what will you do for a living later on? On the other hand, it was a time when there was the economic situation in Europe was not all that bad, and he said, it doesn't matter what you study, you'll be jobless anyway. And so if you study chemistry then and you're jobless, you will be unhappy because you need a laboratory. But if you study Sanskrit and you're jobless, well, all you need is a library card. You can go to the library and read books and you'll still be engaged in what you're interested in. So perhaps it's a wise choice. And so on the whole, in my immediate surroundings, my relatives were supportive. Above all, my grandmother, my mother's mother, she's Indonesian. She understood immediately what Sanskrit is and all the wonderful things that you can read in Sanskrit and what things Sanskrit gives you access to. So while other persons in my immediate surroundings said, well, okay, if that's what you want, fine. She was the one person who said, yes, go for it. And that was a quite welcome support at the time.
And so you then did go to Utrecht and you studied Sanskrit. What are your favorite memories from your time as a student? Was there any subject that you particularly liked? Any course? Any instructor who made a particularly positive impression on you?
This is a
hard. Or is that an embarrassment of riches?
No. Well, yes, it is an embarrassment of riches because I didn't know that Utrecht at that time had such an interesting institute of Indian studies. Jan Honda was still there. He was one of my teachers. He was a very dominating and highly impressive personality. And pupils of his also taught Sanskrit. My first Sanskrit teacher was Tun Chaudhrian, who passed away a few years ago, unfortunately, far too young, if you ask me. Highly interesting person and a highly gifted teacher. And in high school, I had difficulties learning Latin. And it was terrible. I gave up Latin and I switched to a different type of high school where you don't have to learn Latin, but learn something else. And later, when I began learning Sanskrit, Chaudhrian was the person who constantly made comparisons between Sanskrit grammar, Sanskrit etymology, and ancient Greek and Latin. And that made so much sense. So it was through my Sanskrit classes with Chaudhrian that I began to understand Latin. So he was a very inspiring person as a teacher who gave a beautiful example of how to teach things in an understandable, efficient way. Honda himself was very impressive in his own way. He was a walking encyclopedia in his own right. My other teachers, Lane van Dalen, Henk Bodewitz, they were specialists in the Sanskrit epics and in Vedic literature. And another person who was very, very influential in my Sanskrit studies was my teacher of philosophy, George Champarathi. Champarathi was from Kerala, from India. He had studied first at the University of Madras. Then he came to Europe, to Vienna, which Still today, we can consider the university in Europe, which is the most important center for the study of Indian philosophy. And in Vienna, Chambarati studied with Erich Fraulauner, and then later he came to Utrecht. Honda brought him to Utrecht to teach Indian philosophy. And I was under the blessed circumstances that at the time when I became interested in specializing in Indian philosophy and had to attend advanced courses in reading Sanskrit philosophical texts, I was the only student. So I had private tuition from Chambarati, and that was ideal because nobody else was there. So Chambarati could tell me exactly what I needed, and we could go into discussions about things we saw in the philosophical texts that interested me. And also Chambarati, because he had this traditional Indian background of how to learn Sanskrit, he told me about that, how as a child, he was 5 years old or so, a pandita came to the house, and the first thing he had to do was write Ganeshaya Namaha in sand. That was his first exercise in Sanskrit. So Chambarati had learned Sanskrit in this traditional Indian style, but he had also studied in Vienna with Fraulauner and others. So he was a person who bridged a gap, a cultural gap, a cultural intellectual gap between India on one side and Europe on the other. And this gap was bridged in the way he taught me, but also in the discussions we had about the contents of the philosophical texts we had. So I owe very much to George Chambarati. Unfortunately, he also passed away recently. But those were only my teachers of Sanskrit in a more narrow sense, or many other teachers who were influential and who have made lasting impressions upon me, especially my teacher of Dravidian languages, Kamil Svetabil, who was a refugee from Czechoslovakia in 1968 when the Russians clamped down on the Prague Spring. And that was fortunate for me, because that's how Svetabil was brought to Utrecht by Honda. And he was another one of my my most important teachers. And he was a Dravidianist, but he had first learned Sanskrit. And through him, I became very keenly aware of the wider influence that Sanskrit has on other things, also on other languages. So I'm very happy that I studied at the University of Utrecht at that time, and Honda and these other people were there. And it's extremely sad that due to, well, what was presented to the public as economic constraints, it was decided to cancel, to abolish Indian studies from Utrecht. So that was as far as I can see, a glorious tradition that was cut short.
Just cut down, yes. So you had, but when you were there, it was still going very strong. It was very alive.
Interesting people in tantric studies, for instance. Uh-huh. Chaudhrian was interested in tantra. My teacher of Bengali, Sanjukta Gupta, now in Oxford, she also joined. We had a teacher of, and officially he was our teacher of art history, Karl von Koy, but he was also a Sanskritist, and his doctoral thesis was also on a tantric text from Eastern India. So there were such people there, and there was this growing tradition of tantric studies at the University of Utrecht, which was chopped down by the ministry in The Hague.
Can you say a little bit more about what is Tantra and what are tantric studies?
Tantra is, I have to be very careful here because there are numerous definitions of
yes.
what it is and the significance of Tantra. What would be the best approach in this podcast to explain what Tantra is? Indian religiosity. Let's look at it this way. Religious life in India is not one monolithic thing. There were many different currents of thought, many sets of religious practices, ritual practices, and all these different traditions, all these different philosophical, religious, broadly intellectual traditions in India existed side by side in this limited space. Now, India is, of course, a large country, but it's not infinitely large. There are the high mountains in the north, and there's a very long coastline. So people can't run away from each other. And once people have migrated into South Asia, they stay there. And all these groups of people existed there, lived together side by side. They knew about each other. They dealt with each other. They also had various kinds of cultural exchanges. And this is one of the things that makes the study of Indian religion so utterly fascinating, that at no single point in time was there any religious group that was in a position to impose its views on all the others. And this meant that people had to compromise. They had to respect each other, which they also did simply because they realized that the others also have interesting ideas and practices. And often these ideas and practices and narrative material, myths, whatever, were so admired that people borrowed them from others. So this process of borrowing things from each other has gone on for many, many centuries. And you can imagine that if you have this limited geographic space, let's call it India for the sake of simplicity, and for centuries people are exchanging intellectual content, in the course of time all these traditions, which originally were independent, separate, different, they resemble each other increasingly without really becoming one. And this is what we call Hindu culture. Hinduism is also not one religion. It's actually a blanket term for many religions, which in the course of time have borrowed so much from each other that they resemble each other more and more. And the tantric element is one of these elements, which nobody knows exactly where it started, where it came from. It's one of the components that successfully spread throughout a large part of India, perhaps the whole of India. And essentially, you can say that it is a system, it's a mystical system of thought and practice. Sexual imagery plays a very big role in bridal symbolism. The idea, for instance, that God Shiva has his consort Parvati or Shakti, but as a wordplay says, Shiva without Shakti is a Shava, is a corpse. He's unable to do anything. He needs Shakti. And it's out of this polarity of opposites, Shiva and Shakti, that the universe comes into existence. So we have a Shaiva, so Shivaite tantrism. We have also Vishnuite tantrism. So it is a it's a highly symbolic component that has entered into a number of varieties of religion in India, and characteristic is a symbolic pair, an opposition between a masculine principle and a feminine principle. And this was something that fascinated, as I said earlier, a few of my teachers in Utrecht. And Utrecht was becoming a center of tantric studies. And now there's nothing in Utrecht.
Yes. Yeah, that's often the way with things, parts of universities that are interesting, that are fascinating, that they're extremely worthy and worthwhile from a cultural, from a human point of view, but not from a monetary point of view.
Yes.
And the fact that certain kinds of study make for happier people, and happier people make better employees, who therefore make more money, that often is seen as too roundabout an argument to keep the arts and humanities alive. But so while you were there was this wonderful life of the mind. Where did you then take your studies? What was the next step for you?
Well, one thing that bothered me about the academic study of philosophy, Indian philosophy, in the Western world, not only in Utrecht, was that it was so so historical. It was almost antiquarian, as if Indian thought, Indian philosophy, is something that existed once upon a time, and historically it's interesting, quaint, old ideas, but they need not really concern us.
Mm-hmm.
And I've already told you how I first became interested at all in Indian studies. It was because I was interested in religion and philosophy as living religion, living philosophy. I was interested in the psychological aspects of Indian religion. For a while, before I decided to study Sanskrit, I was thinking of studying psychology because I was fascinated by the writings of C.G. Jung. Jung was also highly impressed by religious thought and practice. That was another inspiring influence that made me decide to study Indology. And I found that in the university, the study of Indian philosophy was something, it was a sort of cultural archaeology without any connection to today, to us. And this is how I gradually drifted away from the traditional European kind of Sanskrit studies to contemporary Indian studies. And I improved my knowledge of modern living languages, and my ambition was to study in India. I wanted to be in India for at least some time to see with my own eyes what people today do with these beautiful old ideas. What do they mean for people living now? So I wanted to have my own immediate, thorough experience of living philosophy and living religion in India. So I had to think of a way to get to India, but I had no money. So somebody had to pay me to go to India. I needed a fellowship. And at the time, if I would have done a doctorate in Indian philosophy, I could have got a fellowship, but that would have meant that I would study in the Netherlands, because the organizations that issue such fellowships, they would say, well, what do you need? You need a library of books. We have them here. Why do you need to go to India for that? So I needed an excuse for going to India. And my teacher of Dravidian languages provided me with the perfect excuse. He suggested that I write a doctoral dissertation on contemporary literature in the Kannada language.
Mm-hmm.
One of the big languages of the Dravidian family, spoken in southern India, spoken by many dozens of millions of people, has a literature that's more than 1,000 years old. one of the leading modern literatures of India. And he said, if you write a doctoral thesis on contemporary Kannada literature, you can argue that you must go to India because there is no library in the whole of Europe that provides you with the books you need. And you need to speak with living authors, and you must speak with living scholars and literary critics, and all of them are over there in India, and that's why you must go to India. And I thought, yes, this is an excellent idea. I'll do that. I did that. I'm very happy I did that. It was interesting work. I met a number of fascinating, wonderful people. But at the same time, I continued my studies of Sanskrit and philosophy. And I was living in the city of Mysore, which turned out to be a very happy choice, because Mysore is an old residential city of the Maharajas of Mysore. And the Maharajas of Mysore were very keen on preserving their city as a center of learning. Therefore, one of the oldest universities in India, one of the oldest universities that was not founded by the British, is the University of Mysore. And there are several other centers of learning in that city, among them the Oriental Research Institute, ORI. Originally, it was an independent institute, now it is part of the university. The ORI has the second largest library for Sanskrit manuscripts in the whole of India. And the people who work there are traditionally trained pandits, kind of people who will go to a patashala and spend 15 years of their life there studying one particular branch of learning through Sanskrit. And they come out of the patashala, they speak fluent Sanskrit, and they're steeped in whatever tradition they have studied. And these people work at the ORI and do nothing but read texts in their tradition and edit them for publication. You can understand that I became a regular visitor of that institute.
Yes.
And I made friends with the staff that was working there at the time. And I learned very much from these people. And they were, you could also almost say that exactly the sort of people I was looking for. Highly intelligent, highly learned people who come from a traditional background, and they love that traditional background, otherwise they would have chosen some other profession. And I had wonderful discussions with them on a variety of things. And these people were among the people who made it easier for me to gain access to living traditions. And this is something that, unfortunately, very many people outside India do not realize sufficiently, that Sanskrit is not a dead language. And these intellectual traditions, which are recorded in Sanskrit writings, are not dead traditions. These are things that still continue to live today and have meaning for people in their very concrete everyday lives. This is what I was interested in. And this is how as I said, I came to Mysore to work on modern Kannada literature. But my many years that I lived in Mysore, it got a bit out of hand. I thought that I would be there for a few years. It became 17 years.
Good.
of course, in 17 years, you can learn quite a lot. And
yes.
I imagine that I did learn quite a lot. I met, and through these contacts in the academic, traditional academic sphere, I became acquainted with, again, other people in traditional religious centers. I met a number of Mathadipatis, the leaders of Maths, of traditional institutions. I had discussions there. And then I discovered that actually what we need in the Western world is somebody, I don't think that I can do it on my own, but sometime somebody should radically rewrite the history of Indian philosophy from an entirely different perspective, not from this antiquated 18th century idea of some smarta Brahmins in Bengal who told the British what the history of Indian thought is, because that is what you find. Now, if you pick up an encyclopedia or a lexicon, some Western lexicon, history of world philosophy, what you will find are antiquated ideas dating from the 18th century, when the British in Calcutta, interested in learning about traditional culture, and, well, what do? You ask around, who is the expert? Who, with whom can we speak about philosophy and religion? And then somebody will say, whoa, we have here these learned Brahmins, speak with them. So these British people, they spoke with the local learned Brahmins, and now we can say what kind of Brahmins they were. They were smarta Brahmins belonging to this current of thought that is associated with the philosophy we know as Advaita Vedanta, going back to Shankaracharya. And what did the British know? And the experts said this, so they wrote that down and said, this is Indian intellectual history. And people back in Europe, they knew still less, so they took for granted that the information they got from Calcutta was correct.
Mm-hmm.
That became common knowledge, so to say, which is faulty knowledge because it's very, very incomplete. And living in India, living in Mysore, again, indirectly, began with friends. And I would ask these friends, tell me a bit about your ancestry and what do you people believe? I mean, which temple do you visit? And how would you describe yourself religiously? And they would give me answers. And these were things I had never heard about. Or I had only heard the name and I didn't know the what was behind the name of this locally highly important religious and philosophical current. For instance, Virashaivism, a Shaivite reform movement that assumed its classical form in the 12th century. 25% of the population of Karnataka are Virashaivas or Lingayatas, as they're also called. What do we know outside India about that tradition? Extremely little. Although it is highly fascinating from a number of points of view. Other friends of mine, they were Madhva Vaishnavas. They were not Advaita Vedantins, they were not Vishishtadvaita Vedantins, they were Dvaita Vedantins. What do we know about Madhvacharya and his tradition starting around 1300 CE? Almost nothing. But for many, many millions of people over there in India, it is not nothing, it is extremely important. And this fascinated me. Here I was confronted with living, high-level, intellectually highly developed traditions with fantastic literatures. And I knew nothing about them. I had not heard very much about them at all as a student. And there I was in Mysore, in the middle of things. So I decided to study that. And this was another very important turning point in my academic development, this very intensive confrontation with living intellectual traditions in India.
I feel that you ought to start a collaboration with Peter Adamson of Hopwag, the History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps podcast, because he might be very interested in you and perhaps others helping him and his podcast fill gaps in the traditional narrative of Indian philosophy, I think. So I'll just put that here as a thought. But
there's very much to do there. There's
There's loads to do. Yes, exactly. So thank you for that. I think that's an extremely important perspective to have, and it's a very good reminder that when you study another culture, that to some extent, certain things you can look at without involving yourself, immersing yourself with the current aspects of that culture, without the current aspects of, what did become of, for example, how are people perceiving the Ramayana 2,000 years after it was composed? You can look at the Ramayana itself and get something out of it without the current perspective. But there are lots and lots of things where the current perspective, because it exists and because it is something very important for many people, is a very, very valid object of study and an extremely interesting object of study. So Indology is not a classical, not a subject concerning antiquity, but it's a subject that concerns antiquity and whatever you would call the equivalent of the Middle Ages and modernity and, an entire huge timeline.
Exactly. That's the way I see it. And unfortunately, what I see in the Western world, this is changing. Thankfully, it is changing. But still, I see predominantly this idea that Sanskrit studies, they have to do with the past. And the past is over. And we have something which we call classical Indology, which is this sort of quasi-archaeological study of texts, on the one hand, and we have something which we call modern Indology, modern languages, modern literatures, and maybe also a bit of these social sciences sort of things, I mean, a bit of anthropology, a bit of political science, a bit of sociology. And there are only very few people who realize that there is a connection between the two. You cannot understand contemporary Indian society, contemporary Indian culture, if you know nothing about the past. Because that is precisely what makes Indian society and Indian cultural different from Western societies and Western culture. So there should be a natural continuity in studies, starting in the past, reaching up to the present. This was something that, very fortunately, I had in Utrecht. But I don't see that in many other places.
Yeah, my impression is that, my sort of historical depth of knowledge of the field of Indology is fairly shallow, but currently my impression is that we have people who focus on modern Indology and people who focus on classical Indology, and they see one another as kind of rivals. And sometimes they are rivals, because if a university will only fund one post in this huge field and the post is either going to be modern or classical Indology, then yes, we are rivals in the system, but we should not be rivals in scholarship, in this common endeavor to understand something better. And so what you emphasize, the link between the ancient and the modern, I think is extremely important for all of us to be aware of.
Yes, absolutely.
So you said you spent 17 years in India, in Karnataka, and you, I assume, did work that went beyond your original PhD plans.
Yes.
What did you do?
Well, the doctorate was, that was over in, what, how many, I think 5 or 6 years I took for that.
Could I ask you, sort of, what were your main findings? When you say you work on kind of that literature, it's a little bit like saying, I'm doing a PhD on Spanish literature. It's a huge field. What did you look at? What did you find?
Oh, well, the topic of my doctoral dissertation was culturally specific themes in post-independence prose narratives in Kannada literature.
Mm-hmm.
And by culturally specific themes, I meant the following. Each story or each novel has a theme. A theme is essentially a problem, a question. The author presents his readers with this question, with this problem, with this difficulty, explains what it is by depicting a certain social situation and involving people and their interactions, their dialogues, their actions. And in the course of the story or in the course of the novel, the author seeks a solution to the problem or an answer to the question. Or at the end of the story, he may say there is no solution, there is no answer to this question. But that is essentially the structure of any story or novel. And there are certain problems and questions that are specific for certain cultures. So I looked for such themes which are written about in Kannada literature, but are not written about in any Western literature I know, simply because they concern aspects of culture, of local culture there in India, which are not relevant or which don't exist at all in Western societies. For instance, one complex of these themes is everything that has to do with caste, the caste system. It's one of the big themes in Kannada literature or in any Indian literature for that matter. Of course, also in any larger society, there are similar systems of social differentiation, but nothing quite like the caste system. And if you do not have a caste system, then of course, it's not a question, it's not a problem, you don't write about it. So anything concerning caste would be a culturally specific theme. Or the complex of questions concerning what in India they call modernization, the transition from traditional Indian society to what we have now, this urbanized, industrialized, post-industrialized society in the metropolises, which is essentially westernization. Now, in the West, westernization is not a problem. It's just something that happens. It's natural. In India, it is not so natural and not so smooth, and it leads to cultural conflicts between the big city people and the villagers who live in an entirely different mental frame. Their view of life, of themselves, of everything around them is different. So everything concerning westernization or modernization, which amounts to the same, that is also a culturally specific theme. So in this way, I identified five groups of themes. And another one group is women's problems. For instance, the treatment of widows in Indian high castes, women who often at a very young age lose their husbands, and then society demands that they live the rest of their lives as a sort of nun. We don't have that in Western societies, so it's not something people write about. That is also a culturally specific theme. So I selected a number of works, some 35 novels and stories concerning such themes, and analyzed them. And that was the subject matter of my doctoral thesis.
And where did that take you? Or where did you take your work and your career from there?
Well, first of all, this took me to interesting people. Exactly as my teacher told me, I had to speak with the writers, I had to speak with academics, with scholars, with literary critics, and I had to speak with them about the things they wrote about. And, well, let's take, for instance, what I mentioned just now, the theme of widowhood. I spoke about these themes with writers who wrote about that, and I had to ask them, how is it in real life? I read your novel, but to what extent is this literally true? And they would say, well, it is literally true. This is what happened. And we would have interesting conversations, and I would go into questions like, well, why is this so? And invariably, the answer would be, well, this is religion. This is our religious tradition. This has existed probably for many generations, many centuries. I don't know how many. If you want to know more, talk about it with an expert. And then I would be introduced to an expert. And some of these experts were extremely interesting people. And in such a way, I became acquainted with a man who later became one of my best friends ever. Unfortunately, 2 years ago, he passed away. Banajay Govindacharya in Udupi was considered by many the greatest, most important pandita in the tradition of Madhvacharya, Dvaita Vedanta. He came from an extremely traditional, super high caste family. And I want to write a biography about this man one day. And he was so interesting. His life was so interesting. And he became a very, very good friend. He was almost a sort of surrogate uncle or father for me in India. And I learned extremely much from him. Also Sanskrit, by the way. He was one of the greatest Sanskrit scholars in the whole of Karnataka, probably in the whole of India. He was one of these people who spoke fluent Sanskrit. I once wanted to do an interview with him, and he said, well, sorry, that magazine is in English. My English is not so good. It was not true. His English was quite good, but not so good as his Kannada or his Tulu or his Sanskrit. And then, so he said, well, if we can do the interview in Kannada, then that's fine, interview me, or in Sanskrit. And then I took him up on that. I said, okay, we'll do it in Sanskrit. So I interviewed him in Sanskrit, and that interview was later also published. And so he was that kind of a person who could say literally anything he wanted to say in fluent, beautiful, clear Sanskrit. And I also practiced with him. So if today I speak some Sanskrit, then it's largely thanks to him. And his example, I've heard him give lectures at Sanskrit colleges, extempore lectures completely in Sanskrit. In this manner, I got through my studies of contemporary Kannada literature, I also got into contact with people who were very influential for me, from whom I learned very much in these other fields in which I was interested, in my Sanskrit studies, in my studies of religion and of philosophy. So also in this respect, it was not a straight path. It was not, there is my goal, I know how to get there, and this is the straight line that I will pursue to reach that goal. It was a rather roundabout way. Highly interesting.
I think that the roundabout ways are usually, yeah, exactly. They are the most interesting. They are the most worthwhile in the end. And even while you're still on the way. But so you mentioned earlier that through your studies you came to realize just how much of an impact or how much of an effect Sanskrit has had also on non-Sanskritic cultures, also on other languages. Yes. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, that's basically very simple. Pick up a dictionary of any modern living Indian language and leaf through it and look at the number of words that are clearly Sanskrit, words that were borrowed into those modern languages at some point in time from some Sanskrit source. And of course, in the case of the languages of North India, these are languages which structurally have developed out of Sanskrit through intermediate stages. If we say that Sanskrit is Old Indian, comparable with Latin, then later we get Prakrit, that is something like Vulgar Latin, and out of Prakrit developed Apabhramsha, out of the various kinds of Apabhramsha developed the modern languages, Marathi, Gujarati, Bengali, etc. And later there was a re-Sanskritization of all these languages. It's parallel to what we have in the Romance languages in Europe. A language such as French ultimately goes back to Latin. It is a very strongly simplified Latin. But at some point in time, also French was re-Latinized for scholarly purposes. Exactly the same has happened in North India. But also in South India, where the Dravidian languages are spoken, and Dravidian is simply an entirely different linguistic family, just as different from Indo-European as, say, the Semitic languages, like Arabic and Hebrew, are different from German and English. But also there, the centuries-old influence, this impact of thinking, religious thinking, philosophical thinking, scientific thinking of all kinds, that expressed itself through Sanskrit texts was so great that quite naturally all the Dravidian languages of South India also adopted many Sanskrit words to varying degrees. For instance, Tamil is known to be a very puristic language. There are reasons for that. It has to do with the phonemic system of Tamil, which makes it more difficult to borrow words from other languages into Tamil. So by its very structure, Tamil has to be more puristic. But also there, we find many terms. And these are always abstract terms, things from science, from philosophy, theology, that are Sanskrit. In the Kannada language, if I were to give a rough estimate, how many words in the Kannada language today have been borrowed from Sanskrit, I would say perhaps 50%. In Telugu, that percentage is still higher. In Malayalam, it is still higher than that. So Sanskrit is everywhere. And therefore, I think this is one smaller project that I hope I will finish in the not too distant future. I'm writing a booklet. It has the working title, Sanskrit for Non-Sanskritists. And that's intended for people who want to learn a modern Indian language, but want to learn it in a cultured way. Mm-hmm. Want to be able to recognize and understand Sanskrit words when they encounter them in a modern text, in a modern language. So I will discuss a bit about the history of Sanskrit, also explain the rules of derivation. So how do you recognize that a particular adjective or noun is derived from a Sanskrit verb root? I will also go into the question of semantic changes, because not everything in a modern language that looks Sanskrit has the same meaning as that identical word when it's used in actual Sanskrit, which is nothing special. We have the same thing in Europe with words of Greek or Latin origin. They do not always mean the same in French or German or English as they did in the original Latin. So you have to watch out there. Yes, Sanskrit is everywhere. And I can understand the patriotic Indians who are trying to revive a popular popular use of Sanskrit. You know, these courses with bizarre titles like "Learn Sanskrit in 10 days," which is not possible. You cannot learn any language in 10 days, and certainly not Sanskrit. But and I can understand those people that they want to create an awareness of this very important aspect of Indian linguistic history and to revive that and to stimulate a popular love of Sanskrit.
Yes, because if I tell you that you're interested in learning Sanskrit and I tell you it takes, you know, a couple of years to get the basics down, then that's probably not going to have an effect, a positive effect on many people. Whereas if you say, well, obviously, exactly as you say, you cannot learn Sanskrit within 10 days, but you can learn a fair amount about Sanskrit within 10 days.
Yes, yeah. Of course.
And also just generally, you know, what do we mean when we say learn a language? I've been studying Sanskrit for a number of years, and I still cannot say that I know Sanskrit. I mean, I can do certain things with it, but there's also other things where I know that I would be a very, very slow reader. I would have to look up a lot. This idea of complete fluency as the only valid goal is sometimes counterproductive.
Yes, yes.
But
it's possible to demand too much of yourself. And in my personal case, as I mentioned earlier, I became interested in Sanskrit because I was interested in philosophy and religion. Most of the Sanskrit texts that I have read until now were that kind of texts, were philosophical texts. I greatly admire the colleagues who specialize in some other area within Sanskrit studies. The people who read Kavya, for instance, I read their translations of Kavyas. I read their studies about Kavya authors, and I'm fascinated and I'm deeply impressed. I think, wow, we have here somebody who's his understanding, knowledge of this unbelievable kind of literature is fantastic. I myself don't do that. I do not have patience for this. Or even earlier in the series of podcasts, you interviewed Michael Witzel, the great Veda expert. Now, and again, he is an example of a person whom I greatly admire. I think it's wonderful the way he reconstructs the history of Vedic society and all the tools that he uses for that. Occasionally, I read something by him. Would I do the same? No, I wouldn't, because I lack the patience. I have enough patience to read what he writes about it. But for me, and as I said earlier, I became interested in Indian culture for its value and for its actuality. And this is why also, when I say that I read philosophical texts, most of my reading of philosophical texts concerns texts that were written not so very long ago. My personal preference is for texts that are not more than 1500 years old. Around 500, 700 CE, I noticed that there was a change in style of writing in philosophical literature, by which I mean that the writing became lengthier and more explicit. And this is for me very important. I want to have the feeling that by reading an old text, I am engaged in a one-way conversation. Of course, this person who lived in 800 CE is no longer alive. He can't hear what I have to say to him. But I want to have the feeling that I understand what this old author is trying to tell me. And the further back we go in history, the more cryptic, the more incomplete the writings are. And this is simply because those writings were meant as a sort of support for actual oral teaching.
Mm-hmm.
You had a living person, and he was your main source of information. And the texts which you used were a sort of, let us take sutra literature. Sutra literature is often nothing but a list of buzzwords.
Yes.
And you need somebody to tell you what the buzzwords mean.
Mm-hmm.
Either that is a living teacher with whom you are reading that text together, or if you don't have that, you need a commentary, a written commentary. And as you know, there is this immensely rich tradition of commentatorial literature in Sanskrit. And that is something that appeals to me much more. This literature that's very explicit, and I don't have to speculate about what the author is trying to tell me. He simply tells me. This is what I personally find far more interesting, and this does not mean that I do not respect or that I do not admire what colleagues do. For instance, the diehard linguists, somebody like Hans Heinrich Hock, and what he has to say about the history of the Sanskrit language and how it developed from Vedic times onwards, and his comparisons with other Indo-European languages, that's fascinating. Perhaps you should try to get him for an interview. I think that would be fun.
I was thinking of that, yes.
Again, Hock is for me, somebody like Witzel. These are people whom I admire immensely, but they're just doing something else.
And that's why it's important.
And nobody can do everything.
Exactly. But all these aspects are important, and all together, they then create a picture that, will never be complete, but will be such that we can learn from it, that we can be sure that at least the bits that we have reconstructed or that we have focused on are reasonably accurate, and are such that further research by other people can be based on it.
Of course.
And if you don't have the specialists in, you know, one relatively well-constrained field who then go, you know, really, really deep in a small, in quotation marks, field, then you can't have the people who synthesize and create a bigger picture out of those sort of smaller mosaic tiles created by the individualist researchers.
Oh, yes.
So
yes.
It all belongs together, yeah.
No, I agree fully.
But so your various interests have led you to research in a number of areas and all sorts of very interesting publications. What was your favorite bit of research?
My favorite research? Ooh, that's another difficult question.
And that could be your favorite publication or the favorite bit of research that you did that never led to a publication. Anything?
Oh, yes. One thing that comes to mind is, it's an article I published, when was that? Maybe 25 or 30 years ago. I mentioned that in this roundabout way, through friends, I became acquainted with scholars in the tradition of Madhvacharya, Dvaita Vedanta, this woefully understudied tradition outside India. And I began reading texts by Madhva, and then I noticed something very odd. The present-day followers of that tradition, they have the reputation in Karnataka and also beyond Karnataka to be extremely conservative people. Highly orthodox, very traditionalistic. Other Brahmins, when they speak about Madhva Brahmins, they say, well, in which century are they living? What they do is, that's scary. They're almost
caricatures of what you would imagine of Orthodox Brahmins. Of course, not all of them. But that kind of people who mentally are still living in the Middle Ages, that percentage-wise, they are more strongly represented among the Madhvas than among other groups of Brahmins. And this also involves social exclusiveness. Earlier, I briefly referred to caste and the caste system. And the Madhvas consider themselves to be so absolutely wonderful and so top caste that that leads to a social exclusivism, to a very strict following of rules of ritual purity, what they call Mardi in Canada. And they have this very strong caste consciousness. And then I was reading Madhva himself. I was reading he wrote two commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavad Gita Bhashya, and a later one called the Bhagavad Gita Tatparya Nirnaya. I find that second one far more interesting than the first one. And in the last chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, there are these notorious verses where Krishna explains to Arjuna the classical Vedic structure of society with the four varnas, Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra. And in a few verses, he gives the characteristics of these four categories of people. So he writes things like Jnanam, Vijnanam, Astikyam, Viparkarma, Svabhavajam. This is the characteristics of the Brahmins. Now, if you read the commentaries by Shankaracharya, Ramanujacharya, they say, if you are born in a Brahmin family, then you have those characteristics. So they see these verses in the Bhagavad Gita as an explanation of a social practice.
For everybody who's not a Bhagavad Gita specialist, could you translate what those characteristics are?
Well, there are a few verses in the final chapter of the Bhagavad Gita about the four varnas, these categories in Indian society. The Brahmins are the traditional intelligentsia. They are associated with anything that is considered intellectual work, scholarly work. So they are the section of society from which traditionally priests were recruited. In many, not all, but in many Hindu groups, you must be born in a Brahmin family, and that's part of your qualification to become a priest. And these verses in the Bhagavad Gita, they describe these characteristics of the four varnas, and they say that knowledge and study, piousness are characteristics of Brahmins. Now, what does Madhva do in his commentary of exactly those same verses? He turns it around and he says, if you see somebody who has those characteristics, then that person is a Brahmin. In other words, for Madhva, what Krishna says is a psychological description of individual persons. And that is what counts. And once you know that, you know how to evaluate, classify that individual. And he explicitly says, if somebody is born in a family that is considered Shudra, but this individual shows these characteristics, then you should not call him a Shudra, then he is a Brahmin. I saw that and I thought, wow. So this man is around 1300 CE. He is turning the caste system upside down. This is revolutionary. And wrote an article about that. It was also published. And yeah, the reactions to this article were very odd. They were very extreme. One reaction was, well, this fellow Zaidanvos, he doesn't know Sanskrit. He read it wrong. Nothing for him. The other reaction was the opposite. So, at last, somebody has realized the truth, what the Mula Purusha in our tradition has said. And we are not saying it. He, an outsider, is saying it. He is confirming what we have believed for so long. Hurrah! Which brings me to the question of what do people today do with Sanskrit texts in India? And I believe that many more people should read these things instead of just claiming that our religion demands so-and-so of us. I remember one situation. It was in Udupi. I was my friend Govindacharya. He had some work in one of the mathas, and he told me to wait near the entrance. It wouldn't take long. So I waited there. And while I was waiting, from inside the matha came two very traditionally looking characters. And they saw me and they said, "We know who you are. You are Govindacharya's pupil." "Yeah, yeah," I said, "you can say that in a certain sense." Yeah. It turned out that these two characters, they were lawyers from Bangalore.
Mm-hmm.
And well, what are lawyers? Lawyers are professional troublemakers. They like to argue, right? So they sat down and they started a debate. "Have you joined us? Are you a Madhva Vaishnava?" And I said, "No way, forget it." "Why not?" And then I said, "Well, you know, as you said, I have been studying these good things for some time. And I believe that the originator of your tradition was a highly intelligent, interesting person with wonderful ideas. So I have no problem with Madhva. I have problem with the Madhvas, with followers. Eh? They're no good." "What? You say that we're no good? Why? Explain." Then I said, "Okay, just now you have asked me, have I become a Vaishnava?" And I say, "No. Of course I could. You could go to one of these mathas here and probably a Swami will give me some sort of diksha and officially I will be a member of your club. But what would my position in this community be? Would you recognize me as a Brahmin?" "No," they said. "Oh, why not?" "Well, that's a matter of birth. It's jati. You are born one. If you're not, then you have to wait for your next life." Right, now that's what I mean when I say that there's something wrong with the Madhvas. Because the Madhvas don't know what Madhva wrote. And then I referred to this text. And they were shocked. I said, "Well, look, the Swami of this matha, he published that book. I'm very sure that there's a copy of it lying around here somewhere. So bring me the copy and I'll point it out to you where it is." "No, no, no, we don't have to do that because it cannot be there."
Mm-hmm.
"What?" I said. "And you call yourselves lawyers. Imagine that you're in a court of law and your opponent refers to an article of law and you say, 'No, we don't have to look it up in the law book because it cannot be there.' What will the judge say? You're not lawyers. Well, if you are, you're a disgrace to your profession." Well, so the discussion escalated just that moment. Govindacharya walked in and he saw that there was this escalation and said, "Let's go. I'm finished." Later that evening, we met again. And in the meantime, his son, who had heard this entire quarrel which I had with the lawyers, he told his father about this. And then his father said, "What is this? You are picking up fights with lawyers and what?" "Well, not really," I said. "They started. they refused to bring that book. And then he said, look at me. I have been trying to tell people this for the past 20 years, and I've failed miserably. If I fail, do you think that you can succeed? Forget it. Do something else. Don't waste your time. And but he agreed with me completely. He had to, because that is literally what you find in Sanskrit texts. And it's dramatic that all over India today, and this is just one example which I gave you, but you can give innumerable examples across India, that there are people who claim that some old authoritative text teaches us something, but it's not true. People don't read.
Yeah, and that's why it's also important to also have people who study these texts in detail, in all the necessary contexts, and who know how to make sense of those texts and exactly what they say. Yeah, apologies, I interrupted you, but I agree completely.
Yeah, and that's sad that on the one hand, in India, we see a very popular, vague interest in classical Indian intellectual traditions. And there are so few people who have real access to them. And it's a language barrier.
Mm-hmm.
More people in India also ought to learn good Sanskrit. But as we know, they don't. Instead, they learn computer languages and become IT specialists.
Well, it is a question of time and, you know, what time you can invest, because few people are lucky enough to be able to then make a living teaching Sanskrit, reading Sanskrit texts, and so on. So that's why I think it's so important, for example, what you mentioned earlier, trying to make these things more accessible, trying to talk about the systematics behind the links between Sanskrit and modern Indian languages and so on. So to make Sanskrit more accessible, even if you cannot dedicate your life to it.
Mm.
But what you mentioned, I think it's, I guess it's not a controversial thing to say, this is something that applies to followers of many religions. You know, you've got an original text, and then you've got a tradition that's based on it, and the tradition very often diverges. And then you have people who go back to the text, and that sometimes has good and sometimes has bad consequences. But that's why I think it's always important to for someone who reads the ancient texts, which still have modern effects, modern ripples in society, to not just study the ancient texts, but also to see how they are perceived now. You know, when I ask someone what happens in the Ramayana, how would they summarize the text? What are the takeaway messages that they have from the text? If I ask someone, you know, what does the Bhagavad Gita say? The answers would be extremely interesting, extremely illuminating, and may not necessarily have a lot to do with what the original text actually says.
Yes, quite possible.
Of course, this doesn't apply to everyone, but I think it applies to a fair number of followers of many faith systems. But
of course, and not only in India, good gracious. I think
exactly, yes.
Christian fundamentalists, the Islamic fundamentalists, they do the same thing.
Yes, yeah. Thank you for talking about this article. And of course, I will, you know, as always, put this in the liner notes for this episode. Actually, a question that I wanted to ask you that maybe you have already partly answered. And this question is that I am about to congratulate you on having received the entirely wonderful and entirely fictitious Sanskrit Studies podcast research grant, which gives you all the money you need for a Sanskrit-related subject that you can look at on your own or together with others for as long as you need to. What are you going to use this highly coveted grant for?
How beautiful. Thank you very much. I'm overwhelmed.
as you should be. This is really a fabulous grant.
I understand totally. What will I do with it? Let us see. Yeah, I can think of something perhaps quite shocking and heretical. What I would like to do is study another language, mm-hmm. Old Javanese.
Mm-hmm.
Why would I like to improve my Old Javanese? The classical language of Indonesia. And as we know, or perhaps you don't know, perhaps your listeners do not know yet, the sphere of influence of the Sanskrit language by far exceeds the present-day boundaries of the modern republic, which we call India. Sanskrit was the classical language northwards up into Mongolia, eastwards to the eastern edge of Asia, but also into Southeast Asia, and also the more highly developed languages among the innumerable languages of the Indonesian archipelago are very strongly influenced by Sanskrit. And if you pick up a dictionary of the modern Indonesian language, when I first got my first big Indonesian English dictionary, my mouth fell open. I thought, "But here's a page full of new words. I recognize half of them already. They are Sanskrit." That is because in earlier centuries, also Indonesia was a part of the larger Sanskritic Indic cosmos. Today, Indonesia is a predominantly Muslim country, but there is still a very strong Indic undercurrent. It's, of course, dominant on the island of Bali, which is known as the Hindu island of Indonesia. But the classical literature of Jawa, written in Old Javanese, is very strongly inspired by models from India. For instance, there's an Old Javanese Ramayana, there's an Old Javanese Mahabharata, and many tantric texts, Puranic texts, have been translated into this highly interesting language, which we know as Kawi, or Old Javanese. And I'd like to study that better and see what has happened to Sanskrit in that other environment, which at the same time would be not just a study of what happened to the language, but also what has happened to the intellectual, cultural contents that were transmitted to this other part of the world through that language. I think I would use the award money to finance that kind of a study.
I'm very much looking forward to reading, hearing, seeing the results of that. Thank you. You've been in academia for a while. You have lived, you've worked in several countries. You've seen several university systems. What do you think and you can answer this for any of the countries that you have experience with, what do you think is good about academia? What do you think works? And what do you think should be changed?
Oh dear, Antonia, you have a way of asking questions. Because that one question is several questions. It looks like one, but it's not one.
Yes.
Well.
And you can focus on any aspect of it that you like.
May I reframe your question into something like, how would I like to see Indic studies or Sanskrit studies in a new form?
Mm-hmm.
If I were absolute dictator, I had full control of what it would look like, what would the curriculum be? I would reform the curriculum along the lines which I said early in this interview, away from the purely archaeological, purely historical, only looking at antiquity, and give much more attention, much more respect to living tradition. I would like to see a much more intensive exchange between representatives of traditional Indian scholarship, the kind of people who studies at Patashalas, in Gurukulas, in Sanskrit universities on the one hand, and academic scholars outside India. And I'm absolutely convinced that this would be beneficial in a number of ways, in both directions also. In order to do that, we would have to surmount the language barrier and get away from this notion that Sanskrit is a dead language, because it's not. Sanskrit is not dead. Sanskrit today is something like Latin was in Western Europe 200 years ago, when it was ordinary for a doctoral student at a German or a Dutch or a French university to write the doctoral thesis in Latin. And if you could not do that, then you were stupid. You were not qualified to become a doctor. So it was a language, Latin at that time in Europe, and Sanskrit still today in India, is not a mother tongue, but it's not a dead language either. It is something that is actively used. And I have learned how to use Sanskrit actively. And there have been occasions where I had no other choice but to speak Sanskrit, because that was the only language I had in common with the other person with whom I wanted to speak. And if you have that kind of mastery of the language, then you read texts in a different manner.
Well, what is your take on modern Sanskrit? We refer to it as Sanskrit, modern Sanskrit, or spoken Sanskrit. There is no such thing as, you know, one unified Sanskrit. Classically, one unified Sanskrit, yes. In modern times. How would you advise someone who does not stand in a specific tradition, who, for example, does not have Hindi as a mother tongue, how would you advise they go about doing spoken Sanskrit, given that spoken Sanskrit from Hindi speakers is strongly Hindi influenced, spoken Sanskrit from speakers of southern Indian languages is strongly influenced by those? What would someone who does not stand in any of those traditions, what would they do if they wanted to learn and really master spoken Sanskrit?
Well, indeed, as you said, today there is no such thing as a unified, uniform, monolithic, standard spoken modern Sanskrit.
And it's, it was similar with the various kinds of Latins that we had in Europe. You know, Latin written by a Frenchman would be much more French than Latin written by a German.
Yes. So we have exactly a parallel situation. And I remember a workshop in Mysore where the famous Bengali scholar, Bimal Krishna Motilal, later taught at the University of Toronto and later came to Oxford. He was there at this workshop and he was to speak about the philosopher of language, Bhartrahari. And he used many quotations from the works of Bhartrahari. Well, the problem already began that he did not speak about Bhartrahari, he was speaking about Bhartrihari. And so he had this very heavy Bengali accent. And next to me, I could see highly learned people from Maharashtra, from Andhra Pradesh. They were looking at each other with expressions of, what is he talking about? So this can be a serious barrier. I see two possible solutions for the kind of person you refer to. Somebody who wants to learn a usable kind of modern spoken Sanskrit. One is you limit yourself to a particular part of India. Say you are interested in aspects of traditional intellectual culture in Bengal or in Kerala. Speak like the Keralites, speak like the Magaris. And if people from outside that region don't understand you, too bad. That's not a priority. You want to speak with the Bengalis, you want to speak with the Keralites or whatever. So that would be one solution. The other one, if you were looking for something that is more widely supra-regionally understood, I would advise rather a southern pronunciation more than a northern pronunciation. And what I have observed in all India conferences and workshops is that the kind of Sanskrit that is spoken in Karnataka, in Andhra Pradesh, in Maharashtra, is quite easily understood by everybody. So there's something in that pronunciation and also in that particular use of grammar and vocabulary that seems to be quite neutral. So if you want to practice speaking Sanskrit and you want to be understood by a maximum number of Sanskrit scholars, do that in a city like Pune or Mysore, and then chances that many people will understand you are quite high.
And the advice that you just gave is extremely relevant for people who are, you know, already involved in Indology, who are already students of Indology or professors of Indology. What advice would you give to someone, or what would you tell someone who is only just becoming interested in India, in Sanskrit, in the various cultures and languages of the subcontinent? What would you present them with, just sort of to tease their interest? Are there any books, any perhaps TV programs, perhaps any original texts that you would suggest they read in translation? What would you do to sort of tease them in our direction?
There's one book that I'd like very much. It was originally written in French by Pierre-Sylvain Filioza. It's a small booklet. It appeared in this series Que sais-je by PUF, Presse Universitaire de France. Later, an English version of that same book appeared, titled The Sanskrit Language. I forgot exactly who the publisher is. And Filioza is one of those rare people who's a bit like me. He has spent much time in India, and he's a trained Sanskritist, but he's also interested in living traditions today. So he also straddles this divide between classical and modern India. And from that perspective, he also wrote this booklet about the Sanskrit language. I read it rather late, but I imagine that if I had read this when I was still in high school, I would have been very enthusiastic. And I would have already then said, yes, this is something that I want to study. I would recommend that one.
And with that, Robert Seidenbos, thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk to us and for all the wonderful answers that you gave to my questions. Thank you.
It was a pleasure.